Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Fair.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
We are so grateful, Audrey, that you get us every week hooked up to this show, and away we go. You almost caught me sipping tea there. I've been sipping this Celestial Seasonings tea. Have you ever tasted that stuff? This company makes 72 different brands of tea or types of tea, and I'm having black cherry right now, and it is outstanding. You don't need sugar. You don't need cream. That junk is really good. I mean, try it if you haven't done it. Celestial Seasonings, they have a very attractive website, and the company's in Boulder, Colorado. And they have tours for the place, and they have a cafe and all kinds of things. But boy, I'm really enjoying it. Okay, welcome to, what's that got to do with our show, right? Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. This is show number 4062. No, it just seems that way. Later on, I'll be telling you about some upgrading of the show we're going to be doing. But I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash again for getting us on the road and get started with that show. And boy, Johnny, this is a kind of a rough time to be riding in them semis. I've seen them coming by, and woo, that snow is flying up all over the place. In fact, I still have a dent in the top of my van. No fault of the tractor trailer driver, but as he went by, the frozen ice on the road flipped up and hit the side of my car above the windows near the top, and it wasn't worth getting it fixed. But anyway, be careful out there. There's a lot of people driving crazy, and they're speeding, and you've been hearing about some of these accidents. You can't be too careful. It's one of the most dangerous things we do, and that's why several weeks ago we had a show about that traffic safety type of business. Okay, we want to thank everybody that's here with us tonight, Mike Serrano and Emily Spears, and they do all the technical work and research for our show to get us started. What we want to do is talk about every week is events and issues, developments on the subject of criminal justice and juvenile justice and traffic safety, too. The show is dedicated to those people who spend their time. I don't think most of these people like to be called heroes. I think it's true of the military, too. They, you know, the Marine Corps, they said, you know, go home and forget it. It's over. But we know what they mean. But anyway, these criminal justice people spend a lot of time, especially now where budgets are tight and they don't have quite as many cops or prison officials per inmates per population. So they're really working hard. Juvenile justice, that's one of the most difficult fields there is in the world to work in. Juvenile justice corrections, juvenile corrections facilities have some of the highest turnover rates there are, so we really admire their work too. But we thank them for what they do. They keep us safe. Most of the time, they can't stop everything. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio. Get your own show. I'm going to hurry up to that. Look at Blog Talk Radio on Wikipedia. That Wikipedia app, if you got it for your cell phone or your iPhone, your iPad, you can look that up and find out about Blog Talk Radio in depth. And Alan Levy is a genius that started all this, and now I've heard they have. Somebody told me, I got to look it up, I'm sorry, 75,000 different radio shows? Can that be possible? We'll have to see. But anyway, you can be signed up, and within 3 minutes, you can be broadcasting worldwide. There are a lot of uses of this. Also, besides having a radio show, you can have a radio show, but it could be teaching a class every week on something, right? You could certainly do that. So any person in the interest group, any organization can have their own free radio show and broadcast worldwide. Worldwide. Think of somebody thinking of that in 1990, right? And it doesn't cost you one penny unless you go in prime time between 7 and 10. A lot of people, I've thought about moving mine up to midnight or something, you know. a lot of shows are on that at that time. But anyway, that's how you do it. Tonight's show, we're going to do part two of the story of Mr. Cashel and his in-depth analysis of the Trayvon Martin case in Florida. And I picked this out. The case is a little old, and, Zimmerman has been acquitted and all that, and the charges against him. But I still hear so many people talk about this case, and it's sort of embedded in their brain how injustice was done, that Zimmerman was not sent to prison. And most of these people, when they start talking, so-called in-depth about this Stand Your Ground law, and Florida Stand Your Ground law particularly, they don't know the first thing about it. I mean, they don't. I've heard lawyer after lawyer. We can always find a lawyer to comment on a radio or television show, right? With a very high percentage of them unemployed, they're probably standing out in the hallways waiting to be called into the broadcast room, and some of my best friends are. Our lawyers. But anyway, that's what we're going to do tonight. It's your part two. I talked too much last week, and we didn't get through the whole segment as we usually do. But we're going to listen to Cashel talk about this, and he's done an in-depth study of it. And he'll bring you insights that I promise you probably have not heard. Okay, with that all done, let's do Blonde Joke. I think you're going to let me do that one tonight, too. This is a one-liner. This comes out of that book I told you called Great One-Liners, and it's edited, and probably some of the jokes are written by her, by Marcia Kamien, K-A-M-I-E-N, Great One-Liners. It's about 400 pages of joke after joke after joke after joke. I mean, it is really funny. I mean, I could take that book to school and put it in a classroom and get people laughing all over the place, but here's one of her jokes, Blonde. Why did the blonde get fired from the banana plantation? Anybody got any idea? Why did the blonde get fired from the banana plantation? Because she threw out the bent ones. Okay, she threw out the bent ones. let's move on. Maybe that one. Funny. The Ohio Coalition, they've been in the news lately. They want some more, they want tougher gun laws, and we try to support them by playing their public service announcement every week in hopes that the good citizens of the state of Ohio and the nation who are listening will turn in their firearms and we'll all be safer, right? Right.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Yes, we had another school shooting here this past week, and, it goes on and on and on, and some of these folks, I'm going to call them liberals, some of them just believe that, you know, what you got to do is disarm all of the legal citizens, and then they can be victims. They're not saying that, but lots of people every year use a firearm to ward off a felon. 95-97% of the time, they just take it out, and the guy runs and takes off. Right? How's this for a green tip? I want you to try this, somebody, and then call me in, call me back next week, and let me know how it works out. This is from Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And these small changes can create a greener, eco-friendly world. I guess you've been hearing the bad news about global warming, right? It ain't getting warmer. It hasn't been for about 10 years. We got more ice up north and south than we've had, I think up north, I don't follow that, but than we've had in history. So if it's going to get warm, it better start. But Al Gore's already made his billions of dollars from this to start with. But here's the green tip. If you work in an organization, she's got a whole chapter on home office kind of stuff. If you work, lobby your company's directors to set up a committee or bring in a specialist to monitor its environmental performance and then take steps to minimize its effect on the environment. So try that and see if your boss doesn't fire you. Hey, boss, I want to get a committee that's going to come in here and tell us how to change all these things and cost us all this money. And it's all for a better purpose, to stop global warming and preserve the planet. I don't think that's going to go over a whole lot of places, is it? Well, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news. I'm going to kind of hurry on some of this tonight. You heard me say that before, but we want to get to Mr. Cashel and his story of the book. Some of these are really funny. You've heard about the kid down in Texas last week. I think we talked about him. This is the guy who, what did he do? He killed four people drunk driving. He's 16 years old. He was given 10 years probation after a wreck in June in North Texas that left four people dead and two people severely injured. And recall what his defense was? Affluenza. His thing was his family was filthy rich, and this prevented them from being good parents and teaching him these kind of things. He was too rich. It's the first time it's ever been brought up in court as a defense, and he got 10 years probation. And this is in Texas. This surprised me, because remember, in Texas, you're an adult at 17, not 18, like most states. You're an adult at 17. So he was almost an adult, and he's not going to do one day. They're going to send him to probation and a rehab establishment in California. I think they said it's on the beach and beautiful mountains and all this stuff. Of course, his parents can't afford that. So that's what he's going to get. He killed four people. Well, the Texas Lieutenant Governor says he wants a state committee to review the sentencing for this intoxication manslaughter cases after this teen got probation for this four people. He says, this is a personal issue for me because my own father was killed by a drunk driver when he was 3 years old. His father was killed by a drunken driver when he was three. Oh, okay. I get it. The Lieutenant Governor was 3 years old. His father was killed by a drunken driver. It's dangerous out there. The most dangerous thing we do is drive on the road, drunken driving and speeders and distracted driving. We've already done the show on that. We need these things out of the hands of these people driving around, talking, texting, whatever. And we need people to drive the speed limits. And I'm thinking about some ways to get that, to improve that problem. Okay, let's go. This is nice. This is Kings Park, New York. They're having a concert, and somebody was singing Silent Night. So what they did, the Kings Park school officials removed several religious references, including Holy Infant, Christ the Savior, from this popular carol before a student concert last week. They said the intent was to avoid offending non-Christians, but the change left others very upset. The school superintendent and the principal, Ralph Osgood Intermediate School, have since apologized. They admit it was a mistake to edit the song and promise it won't happen again. Yeah. But can you believe that? I mean, if you don't like the song, don't listen to it. Plug up your ears or respect somebody's right to do what they're doing. Okay, that's too long. Here's another case of the Nutso School Administrations. This is in Gaston County, North Carolina. That surprises me, around Charlotte. Can't believe it. A five-year-old boy was reportedly suspended from school after making a gun gesture with his hand on the playground. Now, I can remember going out in the playground and quote-unquote playing army, and we would shoot each other, act like we had rifles and guns, and the girls would participate in it also, besides just standing around. His father, David Hendricks, was furious when he found this out. He said he was playing on the playground. He said, I just felt like the punishment was way too severe. So the boy was issued a one-day suspension from school. And Hendricks wanted the issue resolved. So he met with the principal, who did not want to drop the suspension. So he pressed it farther. This is the father. The father says, I requested an immediate meeting that night with him and the whole school board and their pleasure any time that night. And at that point, they decided it was not worth it, not worth it, not worth it. And they dropped everything right then and there, so the boy was not suspended. But can you believe that? That stuff. I mean, that is absolutely nuts. I mean, what else? Oh, my gosh. I thought this was interesting, related to criminal justice in some ways, but not in others, but related to all of us in lots of ways. 72% of Americans say big government is a greater threat to the United States in the future than big business or big labor, and that's a record high in nearly a 50-year history of tracking these reports. Isn't that interesting? And we feel fear. Big government. I think this is the time for the – I've heard people say it as recently as tonight. This is the time for the Libertarian Party to get serious again about running some people for the national positions. And, you know, Senate, Congress, President of the United States, I mean, when can we stop them? I want to talk about it next week, but if you have not read The Waste Book by Senator Colburn, you will not believe it. He's been doing it now for about 4 years. It's a free download. It's called, The Waste Book. Please just Google that. Mr. Google will find it for you. You will not believe what we're spending money on. Millions and sometimes billions of dollars on absolutely worthless things, and they have never been used for anything, and he's been tracking this every year. Isn't that something? Okay, we'll finish up the news with this. Have you heard about this guy that wanted to work? I mean, he's a hard-working guy, apparently, and he wanted to get a job at McDonald's. So they charged this 31-year-old Tevin Cavill Monroe with brandishing a firearm, carrying a concealed weapon, and disorderly conduct after he took an unorthodox approach to procuring employment. Here's what he did. Monroe reportedly shows up at McDonald's on St. Paul's Boulevard and asks the store manager for an application. Police said that after the manager explained twice that the application process was handled online, Monroe lifted his shirt and revealed a gun tucked in his waistband. The manager reportedly asked Monroe to have a seat, found a paper application, and then while he was working on the paper application, the manager called the police. Police arrested Monroe while he was filling out the application. By the way, he did not get the position. Can you believe I'm going to go apply for a job? I want to get the application in my hands right now, so I'm going to pull a gun on you. Too much. Really too much. Okay. We're going to go right now and listen to the second portion of Mr. Cashel's discussion, and I think you're going to enjoy this, as usual. And his book is If I Had a Son, Race, Guns, and the Railroading of George Zimmerman. We're going to kind of pick it up about halfway through his presentation, so give me time to kind of find that exactly, and away we go.
Anyhow, of those 150,000 deaths of young black men, he finally finds one that's worthy of his attention, and that is the death of Trayvon Martin, and for all the wrong reasons. George Zimmerman follows Trayvon as he walks through the retreat. He's in his car. He knows enough not to confront him. He's never confronted a suspect before. Then he sees him running. The dispatcher says, which way is he running? And Zimmerman can't tell from his truck because he's cut out behind the building. He gets out of his truck at that point. He starts walking after him. And the dispatcher says, are you following him? And Zimmerman says, yes. And then the dispatcher says, we don't need you to do that. Now, the dispatcher, by the way, didn't order him not to. He can't. He's a dispatcher. He's not a police officer. He has no authority over George Zimmerman. He says, we don't need to do that. He can't. He's a dispatcher. He's not a police officer. He has no authority over George Zimmerman. He says, we don't need you to do that. 9 out of 10 times that clip was played on national TV, they ended it with, we don't need you to do that. They edited it out, the next word. Okay. So Zimmerman said next. Okay. He stopped. Stops following him. Walks down the cut through to get the address. Trayvon Martin has run away. He has 4 minutes to run under 100 yards to the house where he's staying. 4 minutes. This in the trial would become a critical issue. It was reported widely right up through the trial that the dispatcher told George Zimmerman, this is Washington Post, New York Times, not to leave the truck. No, the request came after he left the truck, after the dispatcher could hear him breathing heavily. Walks over to one street to get an address where he can meet the dispatcher. He knows that the cop is on the way. So, yes, you still want the cop to come? Yes, I still want him to come. I don't know where this kid is. What's your address? They asked George Zimmerman. I'm not going to give that out. You could be hanging around here. So he starts walking back towards his truck, and then he's met at the intersection, and this is the critical T intersection where the east-west cut through meets the north-south dog walk in between the backs of the houses, and Trayvon Martin confronts him, according to George Zimmerman. And Trayvon says, you got a problem? And George Zimmerman said, no, I don't have a problem. And then Trayvon Martin cold cocks him, sucker punches him, and says, you do now, MF. George Zimmerman stumbles, starts stumbling down. Trayvon Martin jumps on him, gets on his hands, and starts wailing away, MMA style, mixed martial arts. So Zimmerman starts screaming for help. Help me, help me. We're going to hear this on a police, on a 9-11 call. We're going to hear this last for 40 seconds, 14 distinctive cries of help or help me. During the course of this, and this is what struck me as totally perverse about the coverage of this case. Here is what we know happened, because this witness talks to the police that night, and he gives an interview the next day on local TV. He's the only witness who saw anything. He's witness number 6. His name is Jonathan Good. He comes out onto his back patio where the fracas had ended up, and he's the only one with a light on. He's the only one who steps outside. He sees what's going on. And Zimmerman turns and says, help, help me. And the guy says, I'm going to go call 911. And Zimmerman says, no, I need you to help me. Don't call 911, help me. And the guy goes in and he calls 911. While he goes in to call 911, Trayvon Martin is undeterred. He's still wailing away at him. He calls while he's in the process of calling 911. We hear the gunshot. Gun goes off. Zimmerman shoots Trayvon Martin, who's kneeling, who's sitting on, he's on top of him. Zimmerman is lying flat. If I knew the difference between prone and supine, I would tell you which one it is, but I can never remember. And he's punching away. The police arrive. Actually, Zimmerman pushes Trayvon Martin off. He doesn't know he's dead. And he gets on his back and spreads his arms out so he can't attack him. Another eyewitness comes out. He says, I'm going to call 911. And Zimmerman says, no, I need your help to do this guy. He doesn't know that he's been killed. Then the police arrive 1 minute after the shooting. That's how little time. 1 minute would have made so much difference in everyone's lives. If that cop had gotten there 1 minute earlier, we never had heard of the case for starters. And Trayvon Martin would have probably gone to jail. But that didn't happen. So they talked to witness number 6. He says, yeah, I walked outside. There was a black guy in a black hoodie. He was raining down blows on his white guy or Hispanic guy in a red jacket, MMA style. I asked him to stop. He wouldn't. I went up to call 911. That's what he told them the first hour. They knew that. They heard the 911 call. They heard Zimmerman yell out for help 14 times. They knew this. Zimmerman, the first thing he says to the cops when they get there is, I yelled for help and no one would help me. He did not know at the time that the 911 call had picked up those yells. I mean, how would he know this? And then they did, the police procedure here was perfectly proper and thorough. They put Zimmerman handcuffed, they take him down to the police station, they interrogate him multiple times for about 5 hours at night. They take his clothes, they test him, they take his gun, they test that. They give him a voice stress analysis, he passes that. And they choose not to arrest him that night because all of the evidence supports his story, that he was attacked while he was keeping an eye on the neighborhood, and then he shot in self-defense. Now, the photos at the scene, one neighbor comes out and takes a photo of the scene. We see a big bloody nose and a swollen nose, blue bruises on his head, blood flowing out of the back of his head. Totally supports his story. The autopsy, they do 2 days later. The only wound on Trayvon Martin, other than the fatal wound to his chest, is a bruised knuckle. That's it. No other defensive wounds, nothing else. 2 days later, again, within the 48-hour scan, Trayvon Martin's father, Tracy Martin, comes in to the station. They play the screams for him, and the chief investigator, Serino's there. Another investigator, Doris Singleton, is there. They listen to him say, no, those aren't Trayvon. That's what he tells them. This is what they knew in 48 hours, which is why the police had no interest in booking or arresting George Zimmerman. That would not stand. If we go back to Sacco and Vanzetti, you need a little agitation, you need a little propaganda, you've got to politicize this case if you want it to move forward. The Great White Defendant Playbook was in place, and I'll just walk you through how this came to be. Because the orders aren't coming out of Soviet Union anymore. They're not even coming out of some national clearinghouse. There's local groups who know how to exploit the system, and they know it's necessary. In this case, it's the civil rights lawyers in Florida, Benjamin Crump and Darrell Parks. The parents are put in touch with these guys. They've made a good living suing establishments about presumed racial injustice. They see the case and their eyes light up. This has all kinds of potential. 17-year-old boy, child. He would become a child from that point on. And they knew how to manage the narrative very, very well. And it began with contacting a white PR guy named Ryan Julison. And together they put the package. And here are the ingredients of the package, and you know what they are. He was just going to the store to get Skittles for his brother. The brother was actually his father's girlfriend's son. Iced tea. Skittles and iced tea. Well, there's no iced tea involved. I'll explain why in a minute. They said iced tea. Gated community. Those are the key words. Every news story that went out, Skittles, iced tea, gated community, black child, armed vigilante, who had the misfortune of carrying his father's name, Zimmerman. Now, this may seem self-evident to some, but it may not to others. If he had had his mother's maiden name, whose mother's from Peru, very dark-skinned Peruvian, because that's because her grandfather was of African descent. If his first name had merely been Jorge, this case would never have left Sanford, Florida. Let me just give you a for instance. And this, I only know about this case because it happened in my hometown, which is Newark, New Jersey, 2007. Four or five Hispanics. Their lead guy, Jose Carranza, is a member of MS-13. He's in the country illegally. He's from Peru. Oddly, he and George Zimmerman both have Peruvian roots. They're at a playground in Newark, which is, you know, a tough town to begin with, and there's four young black people, black kids, two males, two females, just hanging out, listening to music. Good kids, all of them are in college. You know, these are genuinely good kids. And then they decide just for the heck of it, they're going to come and hassle them. And they do. And it gets out of hand, and they start sexually molesting the two girls. They take out the machetes. They go to slash the one girl's throat or just tickle her throat with the machete, and she sees her own blood. She jumps up and starts running away. And then they shoot all four of them, kill three of them, right? Ever heard of this case? No, how about that? That's incredible. No Al Sharpton, no Jesse Jackson. And you know why? not just because he has an Hispanic name, Jose Carranza, but because he's an illegal immigrant. And what's the narrative to come out of something like this? The only narrative would be illegal immigration is bad, or it's certainly not good. It's certainly something we should pay attention to. And the last thing the operatives who out of Washington want is Hispanic-Black friction, because that would undo the base, and it would be problematic. So the Carranza case gets buried. If George Zimmerman had the name Jorge Zimmerman, an illegal immigrant, you never would have heard of this case. You never would have heard of it. That's the way the process works. In any case, they put the package together, and it's amazing how quickly the media bid on this. They said, it took a lot of work. It was hard. It took 40 minutes for CBS's This Morning to approve the green light doing the show and bringing the parents on, Trayvon Martin's parents on, to do the show in New York. 40 minutes. That's all it took. They bring them on the show, and now we're back to what they call, there's two words I hate to use, but I'm going to use one of them here anyhow. One is meme. I don't even know what that means, but I hear it all the time. And the other is optics, which is another word I think is stupid, but it's used all the time. The optics of this case is they needed both parents to come and to make the case for Trayvon's innocence. Now, I don't begrudge the parents their sorrow and their grief, their anger, even if it's displaced. I mean, parents, if you lose a kid like that, fully understandable. I do blame the people who are manipulating them. And to do this, they had to undo Trayvon's, the real tragedy of Trayvon Martin's life, which was his family history. Because what happened is when Trayvon Martin was 3, his father left his mother. For the next 12 years, he was raised largely by his stepmother, Alicia Stanley, who was cut totally out of the narrative. Until he was 15, Trayvon Martin's father is a truck driver and probably on the road a lot. His mother is a college graduate, making good money, his biological mother. And they're very presentable people. And, I sat behind them at trial. They're formidable. I mean, you really, you pay attention to when they're there. They had to reunite them for this case. Now, what that meant is that the stepmother got cut out. Well, she got cut out anyhow 2 years earlier because the father left her for Brandy Green, the woman in Sanford. Trayvon Martin was 15 at the time. As the stepmother said, I was his rock. That rock was pulled out from underneath him. He had no foundation then. That's when his life started spiraling downhill, and his parents really didn't even know it because they were being shielded by the bizarre policies of the Miami-Dade School Police Department, where they treated all crimes as school infractions. So when Trayvon Martin was busted several months earlier for being caught with stolen female jewelry and burglary tools, he got a suspension for 10 days from school, no police report, even though this is a police department. And when he got caught with marijuana pipe again, another suspension. He had missed 53 days already that school year. And his parents didn't even know this because the school district was covering up for him. But that was part of the package. Parents, Skittles, Ice Tea, gated community, so on. Then Al Sharpton comes on board. So you go from local to national. Jesse Jackson sees Al Sharpton on board. He can't not get on board. He gets on board. The NAACP, Vangelis, whose father is white and is whiter than George Zimmerman in total, gets on board because he can't let these guys upstage him. So now they're all on board. They're all coming down to Sanford, Florida, and they're staging marches and rallies, agitation and propaganda, and they're being sponsored and helped by the Justice Department's Community Relations Service, which has been sent there to help them organize their marches. And Al Sharpton said, and here he's right, he said, we had to march to even get a trial. Is that how justice is done? I think they had to march to get a trial. Now, meanwhile, the prosecutors would say, there's no pressure. We didn't yield the pressure. But Sharpton's right here. We had to march to get a trial. Meanwhile, it's moving up. The media's getting crazy about it. They're taking care of it. I first heard about this case when we were in Ireland. It was made on Irish TV. Big story. And then on March 23rd, about 3 weeks, 4 weeks after the shooting, Barack Obama gets the ball. And he gives me the title of the book. When he gives it otherwise sort of benign talk about the case, and then he says at the end, gratuitously, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. Which means that my injustice in Barack Obama's America has two channels, people who look like me and people who don't. George Zimmerman was an Obama supporter. He was a civil rights activist. He had worked his whole life for racial justice. He took a black girl to the prom. His first fiancée was Hispanic. But he doesn't look enough like Barack Obama to merit his equal sense of justice. And he was thrown out in the bitter cold. Then the media begin not just biasing the case, they begin to corrupt the case in ways that are almost comical. NBC starts it. You remember I told you earlier, this guy looks like he's up to no good. He's just wandering around. He's in the rain, blah, blah, blah. What's he look like? Is he black, white, or Hispanic? He looks black. What's he wearing? He's wearing a hoodie, dark hoodie, gray hoodie, sneakers, jeans or sweatpants. Here's how NBC and the Today Show edits that whole exchange down. The guy looks like he's up to no. Here's what they put Zimmerman up there saying, and they put the words on the screen to go with the voiceover. Here's all that the viewer hears. The guy looks like he's up to no good. He looks black. He's wearing a hoodie. Right? They ran this at least a dozen times, including a big special one morning on the Today Show. The Zimmermans are suing him for $2 million, and well, they should. But people in the audience don't know otherwise. I mean, there's no reason to suspect that. If you believe and trust what you see on NBC, on the Today Show, established show, why would they do something so false? And then in the course of the show, and they have the tape, are you following him? You don't need to do that. Click. No, okay. The okay is gone. At the end, they close the segment with, he looks like he's up to no good. He looks black, right? Now, the hoodie was always irrelevant. It was raining. Zimmerman never made a case. He never mentioned a hoodie after they asked him what he was wearing. That made sense in the rain, right? Not to be outdone. CNN comes in. This is all going on the same time. It's not the same week. They're all competing to see who can corrupt this case most. And CNN's case, by the way, and you're being prodded by shows like internet shows or current TV shows like The Young Turks, where this whole meme was discovered. And that is that a member of their audience, upon hearing the dispatcher tape, says, you know, when you hear this thing, he goes, it's effing. I think he's saying it's effing coons. One person in the Young Turk audience calls that in, and the Young Turk hostess says, I get so angry when people say there's no racism in America, calls that in. And it validates that narrative. He's saying, coons, that word is coons. That's all you hear when you hear it. John Stewart says, that's not a word. John Stewart is having more and more honest moments. Congratulations, John. That's not a word. Well, CNN decides that he's saying those effing coons, right? Now, George Zimmerman is a 28-year-old Hispanic civil rights activist, Democrat. I talked to his father. And oddly, we met at the Hooters in Sanford, Florida. But his father says he doesn't even know that word. He didn't know the racial implications of that. He never heard of that word. How would he know that? But they attribute that to him. CNN, then they bring in a specialist to decipher the thing. And they said, yeah, we heard it. It sounds like coons to us. Sounds like coons. And the audience at home is saying, and you hear the word, there's no word. It's just something. Well, the prosecution settled on punks, if you recall. And they made a big deal about punks. Fortunately, they dropped the coons because they're so ridiculous. Even CNN had a back office. ABC, not to be undone. ABC was worse, by the way, all the way through. ABC says, oh, we have a police surveillance video from inside the station that shows that George Zimmerman has no wounds. Well, what they don't say, and this was busted by the heroes of my book, The Conservative Treehouse, which is a blog that did more better work on this case than all the networks combined. An unpaid blog, 8 administrators, 7 of them female, did a better job on this case than all the major media combined. Now, they say, well, let's look at this video. The surveillance video is moving. The image is moving. This is a surveillance video. It doesn't move. What you're looking at is an iPhone video taken by someone on the inside of a police surveillance video, and in a generational loss, all clarity is lost. You don't see the wounds bleeding. I mean, you see anything. It's like all fuzzy, fuzzy, fuzzy. Well, CBS, not to be undone, takes that, and they run with that same story the next day. They didn't read the Conservative Treehouse the next morning. They add their own bit of detail. The funeral director in Florida says he's looked at Trayvon Martin's body, and there's no wounds on his knuckles or his hands. They could have just checked with the autopsy. The autopsy said what the wounds were. The funeral director, by the way, turns out to be an activist in the Crump Park School of South Florida activism. It was not innocent bystander. The media, the conservative media, aren't much better. I'm going to tell you this. They were somewhere, by the way. The blog's great, just like there's some very good liberal blogs. But National Review's Rich Lowry, you can always be counted on to say something like this. He goes, he has an article in the New York Post called "Shocker: Sharpton is right for once." No, he wasn't. This was weeks after the conservative treehouse had totally dissected the case and legal insurrection. TalkLeft.com. They were all over this case by end of March. They knew what had happened. I wrote my first article on this on April 5th. I went back, and 95% of it holds up. I mean, the information was there. Wasn't a great mystery, but that was enough. Florida wilts under pressure. The Republican governor, Scott, appoints a Republican prosecutor, Angela Corey, but they wanted to be. I could see Angela Corey. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I saw in her prosecutor Kramer from Bonfire of the Vanities wanting to be on the side of the angels for once, tired of prosecuting the same old poor people, wanting to have the great white defendant, who fortunately had the name Zimmerman. If he hadn't, they would have left alone, but that he had that, and that he was being, if not white for the first 2 weeks, he was simply white. And the New York Times, Lisette Alvarez, who's lighter skinned than George Zimmerman, designated him famously a white Hispanic, a new designation. And now he was, which made him vulnerable. He's not an Hispanic, he's a white Hispanic. We can try him. And that's what it is. And as Al Sharpton said, we had to march to even get a trial. Now, final question. What happens, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, when you try an innocent man in a county that is demographically representative? The answer? They'll be acquitted. And that was, you know, because I did a lot of media during the summer. People said, what's going to happen? I'm going to be acquitted. How can you say that? I said, well, because he's innocent. And there's no reason to believe that Seminole County, Florida, which is roughly 10% black and roughly 10% Hispanic, will produce a jury like the downtown L.A. jury that freed O.J. Simpson. No, they produced a totally representative jury. Now, what's interesting is some trial observations. If you heard this once, you heard it 1,000 times. The jury was all white, right? Can we hear that? All the jury's all white. But sometimes they say it's all white with one Hispanic. Well, after the trial, we learned, and those who were there could see it, that the one juror was clearly of African descent. She's Puerto Rican, but she was more African, at least as African as Barack Obama. And yet, for the 3 weeks of the trial, she was part of the all-white jury. This is how the media work. It's really pretty astonishing. But this case was coming to trial, and this is what made it interesting to me. I've never seen anything like this, where the whole industry, the grievance industry, got behind the media, you know, the president, the attorney general, the state of Florida got behind sending an innocent man to trial in a place where he's going to get a fair trial. This is not a can you can kick down the road. And we're used to, you know, and I've, in the research I've done on other stories, I'm used to exposing something and then, you know, the media or the administration, whatever, just kick the can down the road. And just, you know, one quick example. I did a book on TWA Flight 800 about 10 years ago. And just so happened when I was in Sanford, Florida, the story broke that there's a new documentary out. 6 whistleblowers said, yes, it was a missile that shot down the plane. Yes, we did cover it up, blah, blah, blah. So I felt vindicated for a moment. I knew the major media would never follow up on this, although it got a lot of attention at the time. And I was asked on it to be on CNN to talk about it. And so I was on CNN, and it's only about 5 or 6 minute piece. And they have some other guy on who produced a bogus CNN documentary on the subject. And they said, I have just 1 minute left. And the hostess says to me, she goes, okay, Jack, there's just a minute or so left. Tell us who shot it, why they shoot it, and why the cover-up. I said, let me just take one of those questions, and I'll answer this as succinctly as I can. I said, why the cover-up? I said, this was in 1996. It was a re-election year. This was Bill Clinton's Benghazi moment. All we wanted to do when confronted with this was, just like Barack Obama with Benghazi, is to kick that can down the road past November and hope for the best. But once you start kicking that can, you can't make believe you didn't, you know, so you got to keep kicking them further and further and further. And they knew that this would be adjudicated in a setting, not in a court like George Zimmerman's would be, but rather in a NTSB hearing in which everyone is handpicked by the Clinton administration. So they weren't really worried. It had to be a little nerve-wracking at the time. So I explained that in my minute, and the fellow said, okay, well, thank you, Jack. It's time to go, and blah, blah, blah. That was fair. And then the next day, I find the transcript. In fact, my wife's here, found the transcript for me. I'm not going to point her out because, you know, she teaches at a university. She has no problems as it is. Here's the transcript, you know, where we have this conversation, and then the final question and my final response are gone from the transcript. They said, we just took it out of the transcript. That's the way to be. I mean, sometimes they surprise you with their level of, you know, new ways to deceive, new kinds of sleights of hand, you know. Just and unless you work this, and you, a lot of people here know what I'm talking about, but there's a lot of people in this larger audience who think, this guy must be nuts. He's great. I watch CNN all the time. But no, not so much. Okay, just a couple of highlights from the trial, and then we'll take some questions and answers here. The certain things didn't get into the trial, and but they were in the trial, I should say, but without the jury in the room. And one whole evening, for instance, they spent on the contents of Trayvon Martin's cell phone, which revealed just how troubled this young man's life was at the time, just how engaged he was in drugs and fighting and guns. Now, the jury wasn't there, so, you know, that's fair, but the media chose not to mention it. Right? There was no doubt that the evidence was true and that it was valid. It just wasn't deemed relevant for the jury for whatever reason. Media don't cover it at all. Okay, everyone's favorite witness, the star witness, Rachel Jeantel. She had been a mystery witness all along, and the media had been building us up to the star witness. Everyone on the conservatory house, everyone in the blogosphere knew this was a total train wreck waiting to happen. And they were just a little surprised by the nature of the wreck because it was so bizarre, it surprised even them. But she saved the day for herself bizarrely when they handed her a document that she was alleged to have written and she couldn't read it because, as she said, and this is a sad moment. It's a sad moment in American culture when she says, I can't read cursive. She's 19 years old. She's American born. She's gone 13 years to public schooling in Miami and she can't read cursive. At that point, the jury, switch from being like hostile to being sympathetic, and the defense attorney caught it immediately, and he backed off because he didn't want to pursue this too far. But before that, she had added the one new phrase into the lexicon of American jurisprudence that may outlast the memory of either George Zimmerman or Trayvon Martin, and that was creepy-ass cracker, right? The prosecutor, who was, you know, her on her side, asked her, what did Trayvon Martin say when he first saw George Zimmerman? Because she was on the phone with him during his time. She said he was a creepy-ass cracker, right? And then she said, and this was missed even by the defense attorney, that he might have been a rapist. Everyone missed that because they thought she was saying, they thought the hyphen went between creepy and ass, like creepy-ass cracker. But And apparently in urban slang, I looked this up in the Urban Dictionary, so trust that. It was what she really said. I went back and listened to it again. It was a creepy ass cracker. Ass cracker is slang for homosexual. She thought that Trayvon thought that he was gay. Now, when she went on Piers Morgan's show later, she elaborated on this openly. The media didn't want to pursue this, but this may have been a gay bash. This may have been a gay bash. Now, if not that, then it was, and as Don West, the defense attorney, said, who I liked, he said, then it was Trayvon Martin who injected race into this discussion, not George Zimmerman. And she said, no, it wasn't racial, and she may have been right. She was probably thinking, this isn't a racist comment. It's a gay comment. Now, but either way, you're either beating him up because he's, or you're beating, or Hispanic, or beating him up because he's, or white Hispanic, or you're beating him up because he's gay, that doesn't look good. But that, let's face it, that whole issue was deep-sixed entirely. I just like, there's a very brave new book out, by the way, I'm going to plug quickly, is The Book of Matt by Stephen Jimenez. I had a chance to meet Jimenez last week, a gay activist who went back into the Matthew Shepard story. And the Matthew Shepard story is not unlike this story, I tell you, and the way the media twisted the narrative for its own purposes. We commiserated over the way the media were totally ignoring both of us. So it was useful to have some people of the same things. Okay, after the verdict comes out, he's acquitted. George Zimmerman's acquitted. And the jury deliberates very conscientiously for something like 16 hours. They come back with an acquittal. And there was lots of weeping and gnashing of teeth. And a lot of it's understandable because the people just following the mainstream media were led to believe that this is an open and shut case. Now, the question then becomes, and then you hear on the left also a parallel to what the Germans called after World War I, Dolchus, which is the stab in the back. Among the left-wing blogs, there's a lot of talk about how the prosecution threw the case, which I don't think is true, but there was a lot of talk about that. That presumes that they wanted to win. Now, the savvy people, Benjamin Crump and Darrell Parks, all they needed was an arrest because they already got their $2 million by suing the retreat at Twin Lakes. You need an arrest to do that. Without an arrest, you don't get to sue. For Al Sharpton, an acquittal, even though he protested the acquittal, did he really want an acquittal? I don't know. I can hear him saying, not that he said this, but I can hear him saying, convicted? Who wants Zimmerman convicted? What earthly good would he do us in jail? Thanks a lot for coming. We'll take some questions. And there's a mic right here.
I have a question, Jack.
Yes.
What was George Zimmerman's life? Who was he before the trial and before the incident with Trayvon Martin?
Yeah, you know, I've been talking to his brother and his father. George can't speak to anyone, by the way, because the federal cloud of indictment still hangs over his head. And what they say, he's not the same person now he was 2 years ago. I mean, if he didn't suffer a severe case of PTSD just in the night of the shooting, he'd be inhuman, let alone be turned into a national pariah with a $10,000 bounty put on your head. But before the trial, his friends called him Tugboat because he was the one they always called on when they needed help, someone who always came to the rescue. His neighbors loved him. The FBI, and part of the reason they turned to him for the neighborhood watch was because he was so helpful. You know, after his, probably the most critical eyewitness, at least per minute, in the trial was the woman, young, nice woman with her little baby, whose home was invaded, and she testified. It was very powerful testimony. The jurors all talked about it. It affected them. And after the home invasion, George came over and helped them harden the house against potential break-ins in the future. And the defense attorney says, was he raging? Was he angry? Was he talking about people of different races? And no. He was just helpful. And that's who he was. He was a very serious Catholic. That came out when he was talking to the female police officer who interviewed him that first night. And he said he saw her wearing a cross, and he asked if she was a Catholic. And he said, no. He goes, you know, because in my faith, it's always wrong to take a life. And she said to him, well, under the circumstances you did this, that's understandable. But he was still kind of riven by guilt over the whole thing. As you know, it's understandable. But that's who he was. Who he is going forward remains to be seen.
Jack, you've talked about the bias, deception, and corruption of the media and demonstrated it quite well. You know, holding to the Constitution and the importance of the First Amendment and freedom of speech and freedom of the press, what do you do to get the country to get back on finding reality from the press as opposed to their perception?
Well, you do with that, and the model is here. You do what the people of the Conservative Treehouse did. These are 8 people, live all across the country, you know, and they range in age from like 25 to like 75, a couple grandmothers here and there. I mean, literally from Florida to Oregon. And they met in the chat rooms of one blog or another, and they realized they had a lot more in common than they did with the person who was organizing the blog. They started their own blog a couple years ago, and they focused, among other things, on this case. And there are other contributors, by the way, who added in. No one's getting paid for this, by the way. Not a single dime being made out of the whole thing. And what they do with their blog is they say, we don't want your stupid opinions about this, that, the other thing. We're talking about this case. We want facts. We want you to challenge facts. You hear like people like Thomas Friedman in the New York Times call the Internet an open sewer of unvetted information. No, the New York Times is the open sewer of unvetted information. This is, you can't get away with saying stupid on a blog like this. And then the defense attorney started turning to them because they realized these guys were producing better evidence than anyone else was. They used them during the trial. They didn't collaborate, but they would go through the blog. And then what the defense attorney started doing was posting all the information about the trial. And then these guys would get into it in what they call crowdsource. They would examine it. They would look for lies and deceptions in the other sides. And that's what eight people can do with no money. And by the end of the trial, the conservative treehouse was the authoritative source on the George Zimmerman trial.
And they were doing investigative journalism as opposed to inventive journalism. How can you have a standard in this country to get back to investigative journalism that's going after the truth, not after an agenda?
That's a good question, and I think there's enough pressure being put on the mainstream media. Sooner or later, one of them, Fox, has done this a little bit, but we know they're not very big on investigative reporting. Someone sometime is going to say to himself, you know, if we actually go out and report the truth, people may even buy our newspapers or watch our TV. You know, I just should say one more instance. One of the members of the Conservative Treehouse realized to get into the heart of the Miami story, he had to do some boots on the ground research into the Miami-Dade School Police Department. It's 150 officers. Even though it's school-based, it's a regular police department. So he's doing some investigating. He comes out of this, he's doing a FOIA request. He comes out, and this is one of the problems with investigative reporting. He finds that the valve stems from the tires have been surgically removed, and the tires are terminally flat, and there's a little calling card, business card from the police on it with the name cut out, and on the back written one word, stop. So that's what happens. I mean, that's the risk you run. Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, that's an incredible story, and I think Jack Cashel has really studied it backwards and forwards and knows all the ingredients that were key factors in the decision, and never underestimate the power of a good blog or investigative journalism, and the Conservative Treehouse and their staff is a final example of that. Well, that's it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn sign off by singing We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go,